Good afternoon, everyone. I call the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, November 19th, 2025. The time is 1:34 p.m. Please silence all cell phones. Thank you. We have the following members present. Representative Josephson, Representative Kopp, Representative Tilton, Speaker Edgman, Senator Stedman, Senator Giesel, Senator Wilkowski online, and myself, Senator Gregory Jackson. We have a quorum to conduct business. We've also been joined by Representative Mears and Representative Holland. So this afternoon's meeting is focused solely on the Alaska LNG project. We have three presentations on the agenda, and I expect there to be a lot of questions from committee members. Originally, my goal was to conclude this meeting by 3:30. However, with the addition of Glenn Farm, welcome to the agenda, the number of slides before us, and the importance of this project, we may be here a little bit longer than originally planned. Just a warning. Are there any comments or questions from the committee before we begin? Okay. We're at agenda item 2, approval of agenda. Speaker Edgman, may I please have a motion for approval of the agenda?
I move and ask unanimous consent that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee approve the agenda as presented.
Thank you. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the agenda is approved. Now at agenda item 3, Alaska LNG project. Presentation by Gaffney Klein Energy Advisor. So let me set the stage for this presentation. With the legislature likely to face key questions or requests for action in support of the Alaska LNG project, and given the developer's compressed time for an early FID, swift legislative action may be needed. Though this will likely require substantial analysis, scenario development, and economic modeling. Gaffney Klein Consultants, procured by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to advise the legislature on a range of energy topics, including LNG, has been asked, tasked with providing a high-level overview of these potential policy choices. The presentation today will address key questions that we may be called upon to answer, including why state participation in the project may be important, what legislative action may be needed, what lessons can be drawn from LNG Canada and the other major LNG developments around the world. In addition, the presentation will discuss related topics such as enabling legislation, fiscal stability, and other policy considerations relevant to the legislature's potential role in this project. The presentation today previews a more detailed written report that will be shared in the next week or two. This presentation will likely raise more questions than answers. We have an experienced committee, and I look forward to a robust discussion. So let's get started. The Gaffney Klein team with us today is Nick Fulford, who has supported various aspects of Alaska LNG project for several state agencies over the past decade and resides in Anchorage. He is joined by Fred Welchy, I hope I pronounced that correct, and Andrew Duncan. Fred leaves much of Gaffney Klein's work developing fiscal and regulatory strategies with sovereign governments and national oil companies, while Andrew brings more than 40 years of experience with major capital projects, FEED, and EPC, or engineering, construction, and procurement, development, including extensive work on Asian LNG projects. Fred is based in London, and Andrew in Singapore, and are both participating remote. Welcome. So thank you for being here. Please introduce yourselves for the record and begin your presentation. Welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Senator Gray Jackson. And for the record, my name is Nick Fulford, and I'm a senior director at Gaffney Klein. I always welcome the opportunity to speak about LNG. My own association with the industry goes back to the 1980s and my early career at British Gas. During my professional life, I've seen extraordinary growth and billions of dollars of value creation from the industry. I've worked on many export and import projects around the world, initially in a technical capacity, but more generally on commercial structuring, host government agreements, financing, and gas sale and purchase arrangements. As you mentioned, Chair Gray Jackson. My own involvement with the AKLNG project goes back over 10 years when we were engaged by Department of Revenue to assess a range of features to do with the project. But interestingly, my involvement with Alaska and LNG goes back even further, back to the early 90s. When I was at British Gas, we acquired the two LNG vessels that were involved in the trade between Nikiski and Yokohama. And we repurposed those vessels and used them very effectively elsewhere. So if I may, I'll pass to Andrew Duncan in Singapore for him to offer a brief introduction for the record.
One moment, please. I'd like to recognize, sorry about that, that Senator Keel has joined us at 1:29 p.m. Thank you. Continue.
Okay, to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Nick, and through the chair. For the record, my name is Andrew Duncan, and I'm dialing in from Gaffney Klein's Singapore office. I'm a director with Gaffney Klein. I've been working with them for the past 12 years. My background in the oil and gas industry goes back to 1980. I spent the first 20 years of my life working for Shell in a variety of international roles. Thereafter, I worked with a project management consultancy for a few years that specialized in pre-FID project assessment. And then that was followed by a number of general management roles for Middle Eastern NOC and in an Indonesian operating unit. During my time with Gaffney Klein, I've been involved in a range of LNG projects in Indonesia, Australia, and Mozambique. Currently, I'm supporting due diligence on behalf of export credit agencies that are involved in a large Southeast Asian LNG development that is working towards a final investment decision at the moment. I'll pass over now to Fred Velke to introduce himself. Fred?
Thanks, Andrew. Through the chair, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Fred Weltke. I'm the Global Economics Lead for Gaffney Klein, based in just outside of London. I joined Gaffney Klein 15 years ago, a little over 15 years ago. The typical economic scope for projects involves conducting an economic evaluation for various purposes. It might be due diligence for acquisitions. It might be for expert testimony and litigation and arbitration or reserves and resources report. The sheer quantity of these kind of economic evaluations gives us a lot of insight as to how the industry views and values properties in the energy space. Also, since I joined a little over 15 years ago, I've been heavily involved in our government advisory practice. Gaffney Klein has quite a substantial number of engagements with host governments, whether it be ministries or national oil companies, and we provide advice on a range of matters from technical to commercial, but my expertise lies within providing advice on fiscal terms and legislation and contracts. We advise a lot of governments on negotiating contracts, on leasing out new assets, and that includes my involvement with reports generated for the state of Alaska over the last decade. The one point of interest is a lot of these engagements, particularly in the recent years, revolve around considering fiscal and other legal changes in order to encourage and enable investment in natural gas. Finally, I'm also on the board of directors for an industry organization called the Association of International Energy Negotiators, which is an industry body that of professionals that largely are involved with the negotiation and execution of upstream contracts or energy contracts and energy legislation. So with that, it's a pleasure to be with you today.
Okay. So thank you very much, Chair. So with that, we'll commence the presentation in full. So today's discussion, it covers a very wide range of very material features for the state. Inevitably, as you pointed out, in the time available, we can't go into all of them in detail. So the content today is intended more as an agenda-setting exercise for the coming months as the project continues to develop from greater definition. Now, I wanted to make a couple of very important points at the outset. So first of all, Much of today's materials relates to how other projects around the world have gone about creating enabling legislation for LNG. So as we go through the materials, if you see examples, for example, of costs or prices, please do remember that these are simply example exercises to help understanding. Our insight into the AGDC and Glen Farm development work is the same as yours, simply what we've seen in presentations and press reports. So I'm sure if there are aspects of our analysis that that would benefit from a different perspective, I'm sure we'll hear from AGDC and Glen Farm later on in the talk. So, important point number two, some of the projects and enabling legislation that we'll talk about today involve essentially two layers of government, as is standard here in the US and in Canada. So state and provincial on one level and federal on another. In other cases, it's just a single layer of fiscal framework. So what's useful to remember, I think, is that any initiatives taken by the federal government, particularly regarding funding or taxation, could quite materially affect how the state approaches the same topic. So obviously, as federal government policy with respect to Alaska and the gas infrastructure starts to emerge, these things will sort of combine together into a discussion. So back to the agenda. So the presentation today starts with setting out some of the basic features of the project that will define or at least heavily influence the legislative involvement. Then we'll continue to talk about how a state or nation typically approaches enabling legislation for LNG, balancing the needs of various stakeholders. We have some examples from other jurisdictions, both in the US and overseas. And there are definitely some useful lessons to be drawn from that. But in this regard, I think the projects that are under development just south of us here in Canada, they're highly relevant in a number of respects. And so we'll spend some time talking about those and what lessons can be learned. Now, obviously, for reasons that are very well understood by all the members of the committee, the role of the Phase 1 gas line in addressing gas demand in South Central and other parts of the state is also a key feature, but one that introduces other considerations outside the normal scope of an LNG project. Finally, for those of you who keep up to date with the LNG market news, you'll be aware a host of factors currently affecting the global LNG market, some of which will inevitably have an impact on how the legislative features are addressed. So with that, unless there are any questions, let's move on and talk about the framing of the project. So there are four features on this slide, all of which flow through the whole presentation and will be present in the legislative debate on the project. And they're all to do with scale and impact. So first of all, 20 million tons per annum of LNG, it's a difficult number to get your head around. And I'll have to apologize here for a slight typo on the slide. I've reverted back to my British units of the therm. It's actually a billion million BTUs per annum, which is actually 10 billion therms. So it's a slip of the tongue there. But it makes the math very easy because, as everyone, certainly on the committee and perhaps listening, is aware, natural gas is priced in dollars per million BTU. So as you look at the flow of gas anywhere along the value chain from production through to delivery to Japan, just multiply by a billion, and that's the number that you get. So I looked the other day, forward price for JKM, which is the big index for Asia. It's just over $11 for December. So a billion MMBTUs per year makes $11 billion of revenue at the point of sale. Secondly, if we look at that revenue as a proportion of GDP. For a state like Texas, a 20 million ton LNG project hardly moves the needle. It represents about 0.5% of GDP. For Alaska, it's very substantial. In relation to GDP, it comes to 20%. So we're very much moving the needle for the state here. And again, it's interesting to look at the effect of LNG Canada. It will be boosting, just that one project will be a boost of about 3% to GDP in British Columbia. Their economy is about four times the size of Alaska. So from that, you can easily see that a similar size project here in the state would be very, very material indeed. So thirdly, of course, for decades, there's been a lot of discussion about the sheer size of gas resource here in Alaska. But constantly the challenge has been how to monetize it, which is why we're here today. So 35 trillion cubic feet is what's generally accepted as the proven gas. It's been produced and reinjected in Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. So again, multiplied by point of sale, that comes to something of the order of $400 billion. If you look at the upside in terms of gas resource on the North Slope, up to 200 TCF of gas yet to be discovered, then we're easily into the trillions of dollars. So again, what we're talking about here is a transformational project which will affect almost every facet of life in Alaska were it to be successful. So let's finally look at capital deployment. And, you know, again, as we go through the materials here, it's worth remembering that the AKLNG project, in some sense, this might sound strange, but in some sense, it's not really a gas project. It's an infrastructure project that happens to be carrying gas. So the entire tens of billions of dollars to be invested is all to do with that infrastructure. So in some ways, it has more in common with an airport or a toll highway or a bridge or even a railway. So it's a huge deployment of capital paid for by decades of steady revenue. So that's a point which I think is worth considering throughout the discussion that we have today and is further set out on the next slide. You may go there. So on the slide here, we have a very simple calculation. It's simply taking, as it happens, next month's gas price in Japan, $11.05, taking off the cost of shipping LNG, and then taking off the cost of gas. And for the purposes here again, to illustrate, we've used a $1 gas purchase price. So if you basically take those two things off the delivered price, you're left with the economic rent available for the midstream processing. For Alaska, that comes to $9.30, which is well over 80% of the landed value. If you look at comparison with Gulf Coast LNG projects, again, taking today's, December's forward price, only about a third of the revenue stream is allocated to infrastructure. I've put the same calculation there for LNG Canada. Currently, the gas prices there are a little higher. Again, they are subject to wholesale price differences, so it can vary. But for the first quarter of next year, it's about $2. So what that brings you to is that because that huge portion of economic value is all tied to the capital investment in the midstream, that then leads you to a conclusion that assessing and controlling capital deployment on that midstream infrastructure is absolutely the key. So on the one hand, you could say that for AKLNG, The midstream risk is potentially quite high as the capital starts to be defined and the project is managed, but the upstream risk is actually very low indeed. So that's something which isn't typical of all LNG projects, and again, it colours the way in which the state might approach the project.
Madam Chair,
thanks. It's an amazing coincidence to me that the delivered gas price is the same for all three of those entities. Are you pretty certain about that? I mean, the cost of our gas is a dollar. Is that because Great Bear promised to sell their gas for a dollar? How did you arrive at a dollar?
Thank you, Senator Giesel, through the chair. The $1 figure was simply based on a range of historical presentations, which have talked about a gas price in that region. Clearly, this is one of the very significant pieces of the puzzle which needs to be added in. If the cost is higher, then the proportion involved in the infrastructure would be lower.
Sure. Thank you. Sure. Just asking these clarifying questions because the public will be listening, and they need to know that these are, for lack of a better term, guesses. Thank you.
Senator Stead.
Just a couple of things as we go on this, and I recognize it's a high level. But some of the information might be more accurate than others due to the time in which where this project sits today. My understanding, there is some form of commitments to sell gas on. So there should be some ballpark range for that, I'd hope, that we'd know. And then the delivered price here, so what you're showing us, so that should be a rough target for the delivery amount, $11-$12, somewhere down there. And everything has to fit into that price in this project?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I think there's a couple of points there. First of all, since we have AGDC and Glenn Farn here today, I would defer to them to discuss where they're at with the gas purchase. But I suppose, again, a sort of a key thing to consider as we look at this is that, like the Canadian projects, the main benefits of Alaska LNG are low-cost gas and low-cost shipping. And because of that, there's much more room in the economic value chain to invest in the very large sums required for the pipeline processing energy. So to the extent that low-cost gas equation is hard to achieve or doesn't come to fruition, then more and more pressure will be on the rest of the project to deliver it.
Representative Josephson.
Good to see you. It's Mr. Fulford. We've talked a number of times. I guess there are any number of places to ask this question. You talked on the previous slide, you said this project is material to the state. Everyone would agree with that. Absolutely material to the state. What I've been concerned is what I've seen as a substantial diminishment or reduction in the value to the state treasury. So you talked about this being a great infrastructure project. Everyone would agree with that. If the goal is to bring on cheap gas for domestic use, other industrial use, I think most people at the table would say, yeah, it appears to do that. I have here a slide deck from former Commissioner Angela Rodel on March 10th, 2014, and she was promoting SB 138 at the time. And at slide 12, she indicated that in all sorts of different scenarios, the numbers didn't change much, whether we had an equity alternative and went it alone, whether there was no buyback of TransCanada's interest, or whether there was a buyback as there ultimately was of TransCanada's interest. And the net cash flow to the state was $3.2 billion per year. Now, one could back out, understandably, property tax, which largely we wouldn't see. And perhaps in that scenario, it's about something just in excess of $2 billion. We talked about low gas prices. I guess, you know, I'm chairman of the operating budget for the House, and what I see is a budget that is starved. So we have people in dire need of improvements to major maintenance of schools, deferred maintenance around the state. We simply can't meet the needs of the Alaska people, right? We can't do it. Or if we do it, it's barely and it's very time limited. Where did this other $2 billion go? Do you have an understanding?
Thank you, Representative Josephson, and through the chair. Maybe preface my answer with a sort of general observation about, well, energy projects generally, but I think maybe one way to look at this is that currently there's a fiscal structure within the state for gathering value from a project of this sort. Because of the scale of the project and because of some of the numbers that you were setting out there, one way of looking at this is to say, well, those are the existing fiscal statutes, but how can we address this huge new project in a way that it enables the project to succeed, but also plug some of those gaps in the state budget? Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on the way you look at it, one of the most difficult things with LNG projects is to get them started. Because with every LNG project I've ever been involved with, the economics are always very, very challenging. They're razor thin when they start. And getting to FID, you know, organizing the finance, it's typically a struggle. But once the projects happen, usually they perform better than design. After a few years, they're essentially de-bottlenecked and the production goes up even more. And so as I look back at some of the nations that where I've worked, where LNG projects have been built decades ago, what you see is a kind of a generational impact on standards of living, schools, hospitals, and so forth. So, you know, the first few years of an LNG project are a challenge, both for the developers and for the host nation. There are mechanisms that governments use to try and ease that burden. For example, you know, were the state to go with an equity holding in the project, sometimes, you know, that equity can be carried and then paid for by future revenues. But I think, you know, as a legislature, as you look at this project, weighing, you know, balancing those long-term generational impacts on schools and hospitals that might be built 10, 20, 30 years from now, with the needs to get the project going, they're probably the most difficult thing.
Okay. I'm looking for a little more answer, but
thank you. Let's continue.
Thank you. So as we move to state participation for project success, first of all, the nature of the legislative package, and obviously speaking to this very distinguished audience today and the committee members, all of you have had significant involvement in these areas over the years. But for those people following at home, perhaps, you know, a fiscal package typically has three elements for decision. First is the way in which financial and commercial risk is shared between government and the project sponsor. And as I mentioned, you know, Alaska has a very long history in the upstream oil and gas sector, so there's a lot to be learned there. But again, because this is a midstream project, some changes in approach may be appropriate. Second is to essentially clarify what the split of revenue and profitability is between the project sponsor and the state. And I think, Representative Josephson, this is really where you were asking your previous question. And, you know, the goal there clearly is to generate a better standard of living and a more robust budget as the state approaches the next few years. Thirdly is this question of state equity in the project. And, you know, one way to perhaps answer your previous question, Representative Josephson, is that of that $11 billion, if the state were to take a 25% interest in the project, $2.5-3 billion of that would be coming to the state. The corollary of that, if you like, is that the state would be financing a quarter of the infrastructure, depending on how it's done. But for this project, because the life of the project could be, you know, well beyond the 20 years of design, it could be 30, 40, 50 years. So with that in mind, deciding about state participation in the project would be key. One of the common features in an LNG project is the equation of, you know, how to design a progressive fiscal package that can address changes in LNG price, changes in demand, and so forth. Now, obviously, with the oil taxation that is here in the state, there are lots of lessons to be learned from that. But turning that into an LNG context will be, I think, important.
Senator Giesel,
were you finished with that slide?
Yes.
All right. Could I ask a question?
Certainly.
So you are contracted by the legislature as a consultant.
That's correct, Senator.
So we would be expecting, if these issues were needing to be addressed, that we would be getting advice, specific advice, from your company as to what we would need to be doing. Is that reasonable? Is that part of your contract?
Yes, it could certainly be.
Okay. So, Mr. Weltage, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
Mr. Weltage.
I believe is a fiscal specialist. So can we expect to receive some specific recommendations from him through you?
Yes, thank you, Senator Giesel, and through the chair. At this point, I might invite Mr. Weltge to give a sense of the type of services that we offer in this scenario. So, Fred, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure, no problem. And through the chair, we would be in a position to support the legislature in any considerations that they might take or any proposals that they might field on changes to fiscal packages, but before that, we are able to support in the evaluation or the various value impacts of any potential changes to fiscal burdens or timelines or regulatory issues or changes in project nature. So we often advise governments on the impact of changes to the fiscal burden, along with sensitivities to the assumptions underpinning the development of the facility, as well as the potential production that will be realized from the LNG, that will be marketed through the LNG facility. We can provide very wide-ranging support, whether or not the extent to which that has been conducted to date is very limited, I would know. So I guess I'll leave it there.
Certainly. Follow-up question?
Certainly.
Madam Chair, may I ask you to request that kind of detailed recommendations from our consultants? This gentleman is a financial expert. I would certainly like to hear from him. I think our fiscal regime is fairly well known, I assume, as consultants, longtime consultants, Gaffney Klein is familiar with our tax structure. So I would be very interested in the specifics they would recommend.
Thank you. Consider it done, Senator. So I'd like to recognize that Representative Colom just joined us at 2:10. Thank you. Please continue. Senator Steadman.
So I need some clarification on parameters, because we're just kind of starting its process. You talked about a 25% equity ownership. Does that include or exclude our royalties? And what's the magic of that number, and where did it come from?
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, again, I think this is a detail that ultimately will be something that AGDC and Glenfarne will discuss. But under the original SB 138 concept, it was an integrated project from the upstream right through to the delivery of the LNG. And as I think you're well aware, one of the features of that was that the state could elect to take taxes, gas, and royalty in kind, so translate its royalty and tax rights into a flow of gas into the project. And that approximately 25% stake would have continued, would have run through the entire value chain. So obviously with this, again, you know, I think there are many, many aspects of the project to be defined. But currently, you know, one of the concepts being developed is to purchase the gas into the processing plant on North Slope and then move from there. So in that case, the 25% equity stake in the LNG would start where the gas enters the plant, in which case the state would still have its production tax and royalty revenues from the gas. I hope that answers the question.
Then the other thing that's a little bit different from historically, because we've talked about, you know, a continental line, polar line, and normally we look at these projects dealing with Exxon and Conrail, and they were very, very interested in stability. So they've entered contracts to guarantee supply of gas, so we release our ship, something online. We don't have to deal with their need for physical stability with their investment.
Through the chair, I think we're getting into the realms of aspects of the project that are best dealt with by those developing it. But what I would say is that if an arm's length relationship exists between, you know, the gas producers and the project, then there'd be no reason to change the oil tax regime or the gas tax regime. That's what they did with LNG Canada. They left the upstream alone because, one, it's a very low number compared to the value of the project, and secondly, that gas is being bought from a series of gas producers in British Columbia. So all the fiscal package for LNG Canada was to do with midstream, and they left the upstream alone.
I think just a word of caution. I look at this project, the cap cost looks like the biggest risk. And so that's always a concern. We're not in a strong fiscal position. The general fund. So it's, you know, looking and watching presentations here, the highest targeted adjustments or flexibility states. We have no idea if this project's even could be in the money, I know, without doing anything. I mean, we were told it was a project, it was a little tight, or maybe not a from Mills at 0.2. Slight adjustment there, but it's supposed to be in the money. So why would we come forward initially with a whole bunch of reductions on our side of the table if it's in the money?
That's an excellent point, Senator Steadman, and through the chair. Just to be clear, all the fiscal and enabling legislation that we'll be talking about today, it's a result of a kind of a balanced dialogue typically between the host nation and the project, where, for example, some tax rebates or tax holidays might be offered in the short term, but where there's a tangible value coming in the long term. So you make a very good point that as of now, the capital cost of the project and therefore its broader economics are unknown. And so it would be obviously inappropriate for the state to start to discuss or change any fiscal arrangements until that becomes better defined and everybody can see where the revenues are, how much profit there is, and the way in which it should be fairly taxed.
I understand the potential huge multi-generation impact of the state as far as it's being deposited. And I understand the language of Ogastopascus, whatever that is. It means a different number for everybody, right? I've never seen a number put on it. But that was used as a term for gas. I'm more concerned about the cash flow of the project and cost over, rather than concentrating on the benefit of the project that we know. If it's successful, it's going to be very beneficial. And if it's unsuccessful, it could be detrimental for generations. So just kind of comment. So at some point, they're going to have to inform you guys. You have to apply. The numerics are so can actually integrate it into our fiscal regime and see where we're at.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. And through the chair, I'd perhaps offer one brief remark in response. One of our further slides in the presentation deals with one of the ways in which governments and project sponsors sit down to essentially develop framework. And, you know, that includes the creation of an open book economic model, sometimes called an OBEM. There was one done following SB 38 with a different set of partners. But that's the type of tangible, detailed step that ultimately will be available and will become a tool for the state in determining where taxes might need to be changed or how the state wants to essentially enter into this bargain with the project developers to ensure a fair and equitable split of value.
This is a, you know, we'll go on, but we've got Trump administration as a wild card. Seems to me he has all the leverage in this game, the state of Alaska, and moving his project forward. So you're going to factor that in. I guess we'll figure that out when that time comes. But it's most likely to see.
Yeah, thank you, Senator, and again through the chair. One of my kind of disclaimers at the start of the talk is that the way in which the federal government decides to address this project will have potentially a transformational effect on not only the project economics, but the extent to which the burden of making the project work is shifted from simply the state to a combination of state federal assessments. But certainly with the more broadly with what we're seeing with the Department of Energy's loan office and with the cancellation of quite a few different sorts of energy projects and channeling that money into energy infrastructure and energy dominance, there would seem to be an open door there for the Alaska project to benefit from some of that. And again, not wanting to sort of cover our materials ahead, but you know, LNG Canada was a textbook example of, you know, the provincial government goals, federal government goals surrounding gas exports to the Pacific, all aligning And what we saw there was a combined provincial-federal package of measures, which ultimately led almost directly to FID on the project.
Thank you.
Could you add about how they dealt with cost overruns?
That's certainly, through the chair, that's a very interesting question, because the majority of the cost overrun related to the pipeline, and how that's been dealt with is a matter for TransCanada and the LNG Canada project. They're essentially the two entities. So at the project outset, you know, they will have entered into some quite detailed agreements concerning how that pipeline is funded. A tariff will have been agreed. Now, whether, for example, TransCanada were able to go back and reset the tariff in a different way, it's all encased in the commercial framework, which, of course, you know, we don't have access to.
At some point later this winter, I think we need to have you look at that project and help us with how Ottawa dealt with it. And they had substantial cost overruns. Keep that project up.
Yes, we'd be happy to do that, Senator.
Thank you. Please continue.
Moving on, and I know we're running a little behind schedule, so I'll be brief with some of the next slides. But I think it's helpful to set beside each other the goals of both the state and the developer in terms of how the enabling legislation for something like this might be approached. And, you know, as I've mentioned a couple of times, ultimately the value here is in the creation of a viable project. So that remains the kind of prime driver of both the state and project sponsors. It's ultimately to get a project to FID that is economic and profitable. Now, obviously, then, once we go beyond then, the objectives of the state start to differ. And we've talked already in this meeting a lot about how the state ensures that an appropriate degree of value accrues to the state, both in the short and the long term. The particular nuance that we're dealing with here as well is, of course, that the gas pipeline will address a strategic energy need for the state. So that part of the debate, which we'll talk about a little bit more later, is clearly very important. And not to forget the environmental safety features which the state will have responsibility for. In terms of the developer objectives, it remains to be seen eventually who the developers are. Because, for example, it wouldn't be unusual for an LNG buyer to take equity in the project, in which case their goals include providing a reliable, stable, and cost-effective supply of LNG to their customers. But from a global LNG supplier, then it's very much more a case of essentially providing LNG to the market. So what we'll talk about a little bit more now is the features of forecasting, stability, and so forth, which obviously a project of this sort are of key importance.
Senator Giso?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the state objectives, your third bullet point, you talk about energy security. That is true. Under developers, you talked about a price to their market, cost-effective price to their market. I will tell you that under the state objectives, an affordable price of gas for Alaskans is a key piece of this. I would say it rivals the economics, the fiscal return to the state. Our residents are paying huge costs for energy.
Thank you.
Senator Giesel, through the chair. I think if there was one feature of this project that makes it unique, it's this is what you just mentioned there. as we all know, we've been in other committee meetings talking significantly about the impending shortages of gas and the implications that has for the state. And I appreciate your comments about the IPM. So what I'd like to do now, and there's quite a few slides on this, but I think we can go through them pretty quickly, actually. So fiscal stability, and I think Senator Stedman had pointed out that, you know, way back 10 years ago with SB 138, fiscal stability was a key part of that. It was included in the joint venture language that was done at the time. And, you know, I think what helps to put this in perspective is that if the Aker LNG project were to go ahead, it would be a bit like committing four or five Willow projects all at the same time. So the order of magnitude of capital outlay is huge by Alaskan standards and by global standards. So as a result, particularly given the long-term nature of these LNG projects, fiscal stability always features very high up on the dialogue. And, you know, Alaska is fortunate in that it has a long history of facilitating development by energy companies. But all the same, the time frame involved and the amount of capital deployment involved is such that I think fiscal stability will always remain very high on the equation. Just to give you a couple of examples, you know, some host nations have done this by essentially freezing taxes from the outset with no possibility at all of changing them. Other countries have opted for a kind of economic equilibrium arrangement whereby if taxes are changed, there's a compensating payment which is introduced elsewhere. So I've put a few examples up there, but certainly for Qatargas, the Project 1 and Project 2, this freezing of taxes was one of the major features, I think, which enabled FID. Obviously, for that country, the profitability of the LNG is such that pressure on the fiscal regime is less than it would be here. But with that, I'll continue to talk about fiscal stability a little bit more.
Okay, Senator Stedman and Senator Josephson, thank you.
Just as a reminder, we have a constitution issue, physical stability. Chances of us giving that up are slim. So we have to work around it. And we'll have to go into probably some substantial detail of, especially if the gas research aren't equity holders or slim. We're just selling. However, they're going to structure it. It looks to me like we're don't tax on this land's going to drop. And royalty issues that you know we'll deal with. So I guess an income tax, possibly for the companies if they're not a S corporation.
Thank you, Senator Stedman, and through the chair. Yeah, I think your comments are very well expressed. I do recall from my own involvement with DOR after SB 138 that the constitutional features of fiscal stability concerns of the producers were discussed at some length. And all I would say is that it's a feature which often applies with host nations. And it is a feature which has been litigated as well, because not all these fiscal stability agreements have gone as planned.
Thank you.
Sure.
Representative Josephson.
Madam Chair, Senator Stedman basically raised the same concern I was going to raise. I'm thinking about the Stranded Gas Act and the effort in the aughts and the request for that sort of guaranteed commitment that ultimately we couldn't give. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kopp.
Thank you. And thank you for being our consultant. It's nice to have a neutral party. Just a question. Senator Giesel was initially rightfully highlighting the desire for Alaskans to have low-cost energy. Senator Stedman is talking about fiscal stability can be tough with a constitutional requirement to provide the maximum benefit to the people. But I think that aren't we kind of trying to divide bone from marrow a little bit when we talk about building a project in a sense of using a word of more of a subsidizing type word versus being competitive for the project? In other words, will the project even come unless we present the right scenario? You mentioned the buyers want 20 to 30 years of stability, and you also have indicated that maybe among all LNG producing jurisdictions, our fiscal framework might be a little bit out of alignment, if I'm hearing you correctly. And if those things are all true, our needs, our situation, but us being out of alignment, we're going to have to look at possibly a reality that this line doesn't even get. You don't build a 42-inch pipeline just for in-state needs. We have got to attract the customers. It's got to go to export. Am I off track on that?
No, I think, Representative Kopp, I think that's a very good analysis. And through the chair, over the last few minutes, we've heard a few remarks about, you know, property tax, stability, income tax, upstream tax. And I think it's worth making the point that in many jurisdictions, the scale and transformational nature of this AKLNG project is that enabling legislation is sort of built from the ground up. So, okay, there's an existing upstream framework, there's an existing property tax and corporate income tax and so forth, but you know, one way the state can approach this is to start with a clean sheet of paper and evaluate all these different features, including, you know, affordable energy for the state, and design a framework which is fit for purpose and creates that equitable split between the project developers and the state. This is one option that the state would have.
Just a timing question. We need some of this stuff in place before FID, or and then after FID, is there a break section to stop this project? Get fiscal terms they
want? So, Senator Stedman, will my colleague, Mr. Duncan, will talk about this a little bit more, but I think the quick answer is almost all of it will have to be set prior to FID.
Sure.
Well, you rain on your parade, but when we get in the oil tax, that's a two-year deal. And it gets very messy. Some of us have several times. And I'm hearing you say, unless I misinterpreted, that our system might be out of balance right now a little bit. Possibly. But we're at floor tax, even under the floor. So, it's the foreseeable future. So it's, we're expecting FID or fiscal terms before FID. FID is not in the future for quite a while.
Thank you, Senator. Through the chair, I would defer to others here today to discuss that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cobb.
I want to call you Mr. Klein. Is it Richard? I forget your name, but I apologize. Thank you. So to Senator Stedman's question, just to clarify, I think we're looking at a project-specific tax bill rather than a general. It would be a gas line-specific fiscal regime. Could something like property tax alone be addressed like a rifle shot that would drop, looking at your slides, I think you said about a dollar an MMBTU alone, which is about 9% of the cost. In your opinion, would that be enough to move the needle if we did something that straightforward, abate that for a period of time?
So, Representative Kopp, through the chair, I think one of the first decisions that the legislature may want to take is whether a strategy of completely fresh enabling legislation, which is project-driven, or amending existing fiscal terms is the best way forward. And you know, that dialogue will obviously involve the project developers as well.
Thank you.
Senator Gnutso? Madam Chair, my comment would be that is a long process and legislative time. The other thing that still makes me uncomfortable with this slide that we're looking at is that first sentence. A contractual or legal provision that guarantees investors protection against adverse legislative changes. I don't know how the state of Alaska does that constitutionally or even rationally. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So thank you, Senator Giesel. And through the chair, I think maybe this is an opportunity to clarify that first paragraph. Fiscal stability does come in a number of forms, and not all of them are contractual. So ultimately, what we're talking about is creating an investment environment where lenders, project developers have sufficient faith in the lack of variability or any kind of capriciousness in setting taxes, such that, you know, the cost of debt is low, the hurdle rate that the company would apply to would be low. So that can be achieved in a number of ways. And again, with LNG Canada, there was no formal fiscal stability agreement signed for that project. It was done through assurances from federal and provincial government about not changing taxes, which would adversely affect the project. And ultimately, that was a judgment that Shell and others took in terms of moving to FID. So that first paragraph, I'm sorry, was a little misleading.
Okay. Speaker Edgman.
Yeah, I want to follow up on the theme of fiscal stability and getting to FID. I think we're going to hear very differently from Glenn Farn and AGDC, and I'm anxious to get to that part of today's presentation. But in your estimation, as it compares to the LNG project in Canada, maybe other global projects that you've been involved in, I could sit here and just from what you've presented thus far, infer that we've got that we're behind the curve. We don't have any of this. A lot of this is not in place. Terms of being able to provide fiscal stability going into the future. But my question, if I were to narrow it down, would be can talk, I guess, about the comparative stuff later on, but is the federal involvement in this project enough to offset getting fiscal stability from Alaska in terms of getting to FID, a project that's very heavy in terms of the capital costs? So than any other project in the world. Is it proper to infer that that's going to be the balancing sort of aspect of all of this? Because this isn't going to be in place by the time FID comes around. It's proposed. I hear January, it was supposed to be December, January, and I'm hearing maybe phase one, phase two have different timelines for FID. But is it the fact that current administration, D.C., is willing so much in this project, would that be the offsetting lever?
Thank you, Speaker Edgman, and through the chair. If we were having this discussion in the late 1960s for the first Nikiski project, that project was launched through a treaty between the U.S. and Japan, as many projects were in those days. For example, Brunei, same thing. Over the years, we've come away from that concept, and LNG projects have become much more commercially driven. Government involvement has lessened, but is still very much there. There's an argument that we're now returning back to the days where government-to-government dialogue is now a very important part. So it is conceivable that a degree of support, policy and otherwise from the federal government could certainly ameliorate some of these fiscal questions that we're talking about here.
Thank you. Okay, please continue.
Thank you. So I think in the interest of time, obviously we've had an opportunity to talk about fiscal stability quite a bit. There is quotes here from very senior people at a different oil company, some of which are here in Alaska. There's similar quotes just to make clear that fiscal stability is seen by governments as well. And just to finish off, I mentioned that fiscal stability doesn't necessarily turn out the way it's intended. And there have been quite a few instances where taxes have been changed and the fiscal stability compact that people thought they had has been altered. In an international context, these usually go to an international court of arbitration. And all I would say is that in general, those arbitrators have sided with the project investors in the sense that if there was an expectation when they invested their capital, that expectation should be maintained if it's been embedded in a fiscal stability arrangement. So I wanted to talk briefly about a couple of things, and I think we've already spoken about them so far today. One is property tax. And again, just back of the envelope, if we were to use a number of $50 billion for the capital outlay, the initial tax burden, notwithstanding the property tax holiday that's in SB 138, it's of the order of a dollar in MMBTU, which, you know, on the one hand represents a very significant revenue for the state. Equally, it's a burden for the developers just at the point, I think I mentioned earlier today that near-term cost is the worst thing for an LNG project because typically a project developer would have a much higher discount rate than the state would. So any costs which are front-end in the project are a very significant impact on the economics, which is what this is. So obviously, this is not new. There were a lot of discussions 10 years ago with the MAG PR board, I think, which the governor at the time set up, and various PILT or payment in lieu of tax mechanisms were put forward. And I think a lot of that could be quite easily dusted off. So there's two features of it, really. One is the level of property tax or PILT, and the second, of course, is how it's distributed through the state. So with that, I'll pause for any questions on this particular slide before going on to talk about federal loan guarantees.
Okay, thank you. Senator Stedman.
Just a quick one on the property tax. It doesn't affect my district as much as it affects maybe Fairbanks, which slopes heavy because most of it ends up in the boroughs. I would imagine in Southeast would be much more enthusiastic to give a property tax on some pipeline in their backyard.
Thank you, Senator Stedman, and yes, through the chair. As I say, there are two questions about a PILT or a change to property tax. We're talking about a multi-billion-dollar project here. It's not just one gas processing plant or whatever. So, I think that one question is what level should be levied, and the second is how it should be distributed. Does it, for example, go into the state coffers? Representative Josephson was remarking that, you know, the sort of state budget is in perilous state at the moment. Anyway, these are questions which obviously it's not appropriate for me to comment on, but it's a discussion that the legislature, I'm sure, have in due course.
Through the chair, at your this slide, I marked it as slide 13. Under HB 4, you mentioned a tax holiday on property taxes that's already built into our AS 4356020, as I understand. But then in the slide PowerPoint, under the first bullet and dash, it says it's common for other jurisdictions to offer that, but we do. That's how I read that, we do. But then it notes the Alaska property tax is one of the biggest potential burdens. Why is it a burden if we offer the holiday?
Thank you, Representative Josephson. And I apologize if my understanding of the mechanism is not accurate, but I believe the tax holiday applies up to first gas.
That's correct.
Yes. So it has a beneficial effect, for sure, on the project economics. But, you know, as soon as that first gas starts and you've put tens of billions of dollars of capital into the ground, that property tax will immediately represent a big cost for the project.
Just to clarify, follow up through the chair. I'm going back to what the speaker noted, that I can't fathom, unless the governor, God forbid, called us into a special session on December 17th, 19th, that we would have the kind of time in a 24-hour day to entertain these sorts of issues before FID. And if that's a requirement, this just isn't, we can't do it even if we wanted to. I guess that's more of a comment than a question.
Yeah. So I think Representative Josephson, and out of respect also to AGDC and Glenn Farn, who are here, these massive infrastructure projects encounter all sorts of seemingly unsurmountable problems. And I've personally been involved in discussions where, you know, there are so many barriers and apparent things that need to be addressed that you wonder if the project will ever happen. And 10 years later, there's LNG flowing out of the port. So for sure, these features that you've highlighted require a very significant dialogue between the stakeholders and ways in which FID can be short-circuited, or ways in which some of these fiscal items can be left to some degree open while FID is pursued and construction starts. That's a dialogue which I think is probably a very fruitful one.
Senator Kiesel.
Mr. Fulford, we haven't heard from Glenn Farn or AGDC that any kind of fiscal changes to our tax structure need to be made. I mean, this is kind of new information to me. I mean, maybe somebody else has heard it, but I haven't. So can you explain why we haven't heard this before?
Thank you, Senator Giesel. And through the chair, I think the best way to answer that question relates back to some of the other comments that we've already heard from the committee today, which is that at this phase in the project development, where I believe capital costs are being reviewed and nailed down, the extent of change to the fiscal environment, or indeed whether new enabling legislation is required, I think Representative Josephson made this point that you very quickly get down to brass tacks, and it's a case of, well, you know, what are the returns on the project? What do the earnings look like? How does the balance sheet evolve? So I'm sure these things are uppermost in their minds, and obviously they're here today to speak for themselves.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
I'll just comment. Actually, they've told us in past hearings before this committee, that no legislative changes were needed.
Thank you. So I just want to make a quick comment to the public. For folks listening online, we understand that the audio quality is really bad. It's going to be fixed in January with this audio system. But as I mentioned, it's going to be replaced. But we'll try to speak more directly into the mic so that you can hear us better. And to the public, please, please bear with us. Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair Grayson, Ray Jackson. And so I think at this point, I'll talk briefly about the federal loan guarantee, because a bit like property tax, it doesn't have quite the same impact, but this is another characteristic of the project which action from the federal government could move things along very well indeed. You know, at the end of the day, if we assume $30 billion of debt or borrowing, if we start with a 6.5%, which might be roughly typical at the moment, and if the reassurance that provides to the lending community achieves a 1.5% saving in cost of debt, then all that ultimately translates into about a 30 to 45 cent per MMBTU saving in the cost of gas. The figures are on the sheet here, so I won't go through them in detail. But alongside property tax, federal loan guarantee is probably the next biggest item that could, at a stroke, affect the economics of the project.
Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. So help me with the definition of the loan guarantee. Is it against default or late debt service, or what actually is this?
Thank you, Senator Stedman, through the chair. The federal loan guarantee is not something that I've studied in detail. I know AGDC have referred to it quite frequently, and I believe some statements were made by the Energy Secretary quite recently on how the federal government might approach this, but I'm afraid I don't have the exact details of how it would work.
Please continue.
So I'd like to briefly touch upon another couple of factors which will impact the approach to fiscal arrangements, because they start to speak to the production tax and royalty that the state obviously has been developing over many years now. Prudhoe Bay is a gas cap reservoir. It's always been understood that it would enter some kind of blowdown phase late in its life, and that blowdown phase is exactly what will translate into the LNG project. But clearly the dynamic between oil production, gas production is a very complicated one, and as the effects of the blowdown and sending gas south to the LNG project into South Central, that's something that'll have to be looked at very carefully. I think there are some scenarios where oil production is potentially optimized through doing that. There are others where it's affected in other ways. And the other characteristic is that it affects the different producing properties on the North Slope differently depending on where they are. And, you know, the other factor of all this is the potential for very significant quantities of CO2 production, which we deal with on the next slide.
Senator Stedman?
So would Exxon and Conoco and whoever's going to produce this gas factor that into their cost of the gas they're going to sell, the price for the oil profit they're going to give in the ground?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I think absolutely yes. It will be part of the commercial dialogue in terms of how the gas production affects, because it's not only how it affects the oil production, but potentially having to install new compression or new pipeline linkages or things of that sort. So there'll be some degree of capex as well that we need to be paid for.
Thank you. Please continue.
So I think in the future we need to revisit the capital cost north of Station 1, dealing with the gas line also, so we understand that. because that flows against our oil tax, which is already below the floor in a lot of places.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Sedman, through the chair. Yeah, that's a very astute comment. And obviously, OGCC have a role here to play in determining the optimum production of the state's oil and gas. But this will be a relatively complex and detailed dialogue that will have to be had with the oil producers and with the project. Related to that, we have the question of carbon capture. And for those of you who were in the legislature a couple of years ago, you'll remember HB 50, which set out the terms under which the state would regulate carbon capture and sequestration. So the one of the major opportunities that the project can benefit from is the current tax credits operated by the IRS. 45Q is what they're known as. And, you know, with one proviso, that currently the 45Q arrangements won't go very far into the LNG production. But all the same, you know, for an example, a 2 million ton per annum capture plant for the CO2, it, at $85 per ton of CO2, it comes to, around about $170 million a year revenue for the operators of that plant, which can be translated into about a 17 cents per MMBTU cost advantage.
Okay, let's continue.
Thank you, Chair Gray-Jackson. I'm not going to hesitate on these slides. There's a lot of detail on them, but you might want to glance through the projects listed on this slide, which are essentially U.S. examples. And then on the next slide are a list of global LNG projects and how they've gone about enabling legislation and, in some cases, fiscal stability. But unless there are any detailed questions on that, I think we can move on.
I don't see any.
Thank you. So with your permission, Chair Gray-Jackson, what I'd like to do is defer to my colleague, Mr. Duncan in Singapore. As he mentioned, he's working on a project currently around LNG and what needs to happen before FID. And given some of the questions that we've had, it would be useful thing for him to take the next few slides, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. And for the record, this is Andrew Duncan from Gaffney Klein in Singapore, through the chair. I have summarized a number of the key aspects just as a reminder or a scene setting that will affect the FID or the project economics of particularly phase one. Phase one, as we know, is targeted to transport pipeline gas to the state domestic market. And as such, that represents a large capital investment, which is in part a pre-investment in the long-term LNG phase of the project, as well as has been mentioned earlier, providing affordable gas to the state domestic market. Also, the point raised earlier, the subsurface risk is relatively small. Gas is proven and available. And the capital cost of this project is a dominant part of the economics. So prior to taking a final investment decision, the project sponsor and their financiers will require a demonstration that these factors have been taken into account and that they demonstrate a robust business case to proceed. With that introduction, I'd like to have the next slide, please.
One question.
Senator Stedman.
So just inferring what you're saying is this, I think we've been using $10 billion. I don't know what the pipeline's going to cost, some number. And have a very small portion of that used in state gas as far as its potential capacity. So you need to address a little bit about how you're going to, I guess, displace the current market, how much of this Alaska market is going to be absorbed by this new pipeline. And I'd really like to have your company cash flow this $10 billion, however billion dollars it's going to be, project. Because it may be we build phase one and we don't build the next two. And we're stuck with this 42-inch line and virtually... What's the percent of capacity that the Anchorage would use, the rail build? Do you know that offhand, Pat?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, it's 10%.
Yeah, 10%. So you got 10%, you got a cash flow percent. We need to see that model, especially if they're going to ask us to give up anything.
Thank you, Senator Stedman, and perhaps I could pass back to Andrew to continue.
Thank you very much, Nick, and through the chair. I think the senator has identified a key point on this impending FID is the transition from phase one to phase two, and the structures that will be required to bridge that gap. A reminder, and I'm aware that some of the committee members are familiar with these project management fundamentals, but for those, let's say, following the hearing remotely, this graphic just illustrates the typical stages of a project stage gate process, and the processes like this are used to govern most major oil and gas projects, and the idea is that at the end of each one of these project phases, there's a decision gate where the project takes a pause and confirms that they are ready to move on to the next stage of the project. And the thinking behind this is that the rate of expenditure escalates as you move through the project process, and clearly during the execute phase of the project, that's where the majority of the CapEx is incurred. And so the decision gate prior to the execute phase, and in this graphic that's shown as decision gate 4, that's normally where final investment decision is taken. And at that stage, all the key threads of the project come together. Fairly obviously, the project technical scope needs to be defined to a certain level of detail. Costs and schedule, project execution plan, the organization contracting strategy, and so forth. But also the non-technical aspects, such as the legal permitting regulatory framework, the commercial framework, critically the economics and business case, and feeding into that how the project is going to be financed and the trade-off between risk and the cost of financing and stakeholder management. And that's in the broadest sense, aspects such as the impact on the state economy and the senators I mentioned earlier, the constitutional issues. These all need to be brought together to the let's say, to the satisfaction of the various decision makers in taking a final investment decision. I think that the final investment decision schedule is probably it's coming in to take a central role here. And if I may move to the next slide, and after that pause for questions, the final investment decision can vary widely depending on the robustness of the project. I've been involved in a couple of upstream projects where, large projects, where the final investment decision, and that's the say the pre-FID period, has been less than 4 years from discovery to decision to proceed, because it was a enormously robust project, and it was clear to all players that they could accept additional risk, but time was of the essence. At the other end of the scale, there are projects, again upstream projects, which have been over 50 years since discovery and still haven't reached FID because of a variety of technical and non-technical issues, environmental approvals, production fluid quality, international border disputes, and so on. So the pre-FID timing is a can be a very flexible schedule, but it comes together during that process of deciding to take the final investment decision. I'd like to pause here and take any questions.
Are there any questions at this point? Mr. Duncan, it doesn't look like there are any questions at this point. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I hand over to Nick to continue further with the presentation. Nick?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Andrew, and thank you, Chair Gray Jackson. I wonder if it might be helpful to do a quick time check, because I know we're well into our hearing, and just in terms of what we might want to focus on in the remaining.
Thank you for that, because we have two other presentations, and it's 3:05. Right.
Yep.
So, Senator Giesel?
Madam Chair, the next slide talks about legislative action likely needed. I think that may be getting to the heart of what we need to hear.
I think that's a good idea. Thank you, Senator Giesel. Can you please go to that particular slide? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, again, as Mr. Duncan pointed out, you know, the what has to happen for FID can be quite variable. But typically in the context of LNG, and particularly given the history of AK LNG in the state, it seems likely that you know, property tax is high up on the list for being addressed. You know, clearly that represents what you could be argued to be a suboptimal situation, both for the project and the state, you know, given that longer term revenues are very much a priority. You know, the question I think is, coming back to our comments about how oil and gas production might differ, it's whether there would be any kind of alteration to, you know, production tax and royalty. As I mentioned, for the projects in BC, that was left out of the equation. And there's a very similar environment here where the relative cost of the gas could be quite low. Obviously, one of the key features here is equity investment in the LNG project, which brings a set of long-term advantages, but some short-term challenges. And, you know, clearly that will be a trade-off that the state will decide upon. But certainly, you know, that is a fairly fundamental feature of the project going forward. I think, as we discussed, in some of the features with respect to the pipeline, one of the most challenging features, arguably, is the setting of a tariff. And I think, Senator Stedman, you pointed out that this could be quite variable and indeed could be quite high. And, you know, that's a good example where, you know, lenders, investors would need to understand the structure and the level of that tariff and who will be there to offer credit. That would be a fairly significant item. And, you know, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but I think it helps in the context of this slide. One of the fundamental differences between LNG Canada, Xila Shimts, which is the project that's happening just down the road from Ketchikan, those projects, there's an arm's length negotiation with the pipeline builders, that there's a tariff discussion, and it all gets put into contractual terms. The big difference between this one is that once that pipeline starts to deliver and or is intended to deliver gas to South Central, Anchorage, and potentially parts of the interior, then, you know, question, does that then become an RCA rate case? And if so, you know, what provisions and resources would they need to determine tariff? Would it be dealt with on a more individual basis outside that arrangement? But either way, the tariff and who pays it will be a key part of that pipeline.
So I'm going to suggest that when you're done with this slide, let's do the next slide, which is very relevant, and then we're going to transfer over to PGDC.
Okay, thank you, Chair Gray Jackson.
You're welcome.
Yes, I think between the questions, we've covered a lot of the materials, but let's deal with the next one. So as I mentioned earlier, we're approaching rapidly the point where I think, you know, sharpening pencils and looking at numbers is going to be a key requirement both for the project developers and obviously for the state. So I mentioned that an open book economic model or some similar tool is often very helpful at this point. And so that might be something to investigate in the coming months as the capital costs and so forth start to become better defined. But I think at this point we can probably leave it.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions before we move on, Senator Giesel?
Mr. Fulford, are you familiar with any legislation that is being prepared to be introduced in the 2026 legislative session at this time that will address these issues?
Senator Giesel, through the chair, I'm not personally aware of any legislation proposed for the next session.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I want to thank you, Mr. Fulford, for your presentation, and Mr. Welke and Mr. Duncan online. I know there's a major time difference for both of you. So thank you for being here. And now we're going to have a presentation by AGDC, Frank Richards and Matt Kissinger from Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. They presented to this committee twice in April. So we're looking forward to an update. So please come to the table and introduce yourselves for the recording and begin your presentation. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, I'm going to have to leave about 3:30. I've got another appointment at 4. So.
Okay, thank you for letting us know.
Well, cheer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Frank Richards, President of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation.
And for the record, my name is Matt Kissinger, also with Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation and resident of Anchorage.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, for the committee as well as for the public online, we wanted to be able to present kind of an update on from when we last discussed this project with the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. And Senator Stedman, look forward to your questions in the time frame that we have with you. So, just as a general overview, the AGDC, or the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, is an independent corporation of the state of Alaska that was created by the Alaska Legislature in the 2013 timeframe under House Bill 4. It was at a time when Cook Inlet was seeing a significant decline in production, and the concerns were around how is the South Central power and home heating going to have a supply. So we were given a mission to look at the opportunity to bring North Slope Natural Gas down into Fairbanks into South Central. And with that, there was a mission provided to us to maximize the benefit of those resources through the development of the infrastructure to be able to move the gas to both local and international markets. One of our key driving missions has also been to be able to deliver that gas at the lowest cost for Alaskans. So since we last talked, we have been actively engaged in transitioning the project from 100% ownership rights of AGDC to our partner with Glen Farm. And this was through the divestment of a wholly owned subsidiary called H-Star Alaska. And this is the subsidiary that we created to essentially hold all of the assets of the Alaska LNG project, which included the design, the environmental, the permitting, the authorizations, all of the necessary tools to be able to make that project move forward. And it was on March 28th of this year that the board, the AGDC board, granted authority to be able to exercise an agreement with Glen Farm to 75% rights for the H-Star Alaska. And we did that in exchange for the commitment by Glen Farm to take on the leadership as well as the cost to move the project forward through final investment decision. H-Star was created, again, as a subsidiary under AGDC, and that really was the avenue to be able to bring in an outside private sector entity to be able to move this project forward, because as a state corporation, we couldn't divest of ourselves. So in the interim, since the signing, then we were moving through a transition to be able to take the leadership that AGDC had, project management that AGDC had, and be able to transition that to Glen Farm. So in the months of April, May, and June, we were transitioning the assets, we were transitioning the functions, the project management roles and responsibility to Glen Farm Management, and then we completed that as one of the milestones of our project agreement on July 1st. The 8-star technical team that we had in place, many of those assets went to become now working assets of Glen Farm. So there was not necessarily a loss of continuity, where Alaskan content is still working on the project to be able to move it forward. AGDC, though, retained some of our technical assets and commercial assets. So we have a technical director and we have a commercial director, the role that Matt fills. We work with Glen Farm on a daily, if not, and meet with them on a weekly basis on various work streams to be able to help in advancing the project and meeting the time frames, the aggressive time frames that Glen Farm is moving forward with. And then we meet more formally as board of managers for 8-Star Alaska. And so this consists of two members of Glen Farm, one of AGDC, and an independent board member. That independent board member was selected, and it was an Alaskan by the name of Janet Weiss, who was formerly board member of AGDC, formerly BP Alaska president. And we're pleased to have Janet on board Glen Farm's board managers.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Richards, can you explain, good afternoon, can you explain, I think it was October 2015, the 60 of us went down to Juneau for the sole purpose of entertaining the buyout of TransCanada's interest in AKLNG. We did that and spent something like $200 million. Where is that engineering, environmental data, permits, et cetera? And is that, or why did we, is it good that we did that at this point? Or are we segregating that work and saying, no, we're not sharing this yet with the team because it's a separate investment? Just give me a sense of it.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, again, the buyout of TransCanada, the conclusion of essentially the AGEA contract, was where the work product that both TransCanada and the partner at the time, ExxonMobil, worked on in advancing what was originally the Alaska Pipeline Project and then ultimately the Alaska LNG Project. Those assets became a part of the collective information, data, engineering that AGDC was then granted full authority and ownership of when the producers left the project. So when the state purchased the rights out of TransCanada that came into the Alaska LNG project. The state was a 25% equity owner in that project. And then when the producers elected to leave at the end of 2015, then 2016 timeframe, then all of those rights and responsibilities and data sets came to AGDC. So we were a repository of that. That is what we then put into 8-Star Alaska. So it is all of the engineering analysis that was done previously by Alaska Pipeline Project, and some that came from the Denali Pipeline Project, BP and Conoco contributed. It is all of the work product that was done under the Alaska LNG Project and the optimization work that AGDC did post receiving that ownership rights from the producers.
It sounds like we're not getting anything in particular in our relationship with 8-Star for that investment. It's just that we removed an encumbrance that allows us to get where we are today. How would you describe it?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I would say that what we received from that transaction was the commitment to take the project through to an FID decision. So that meant all of the expenses, all of the work products, all of the contracts, all the engineering analysis, requests for quotes that Glen Farm is now doing, we'll explain to you shortly. That effort is being borne by them. It means that there's no more money required of the state to advance this project. Had Glen Farm not come forward and executed this agreement, the project may be sitting on a shelf, and we wouldn't be actually advancing.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, with the transition to Glen Farm's leadership, our role now is to act as the state's representative in that minority role. So that's the 25% ownership. What does this mean? We represent and advocate for Alaska's interest. So again, I go back to we are the state of Alaska's corporation, and our mission, as I stated previously, is to advance this project, but also to commercialize those resources and provide lowest cost gas for Alaskans. So with our agreement, we're obligated to not provide any additional future funding to maintain our ownership that we currently have in the 8-Star Alaska project company. But we will receive what we call developer economics, and we'll explain that on a further slide. Our focus is working on Glen Farm and pushing the project forward as best they can with the expertise that we can also help to provide them and understanding the project, but also in engaging with Alaskans. And that's where the interface between Alaska content through an AGDC is allowing the project to be able to proceed and look forward to construction utilizing Alaska contract. Our focus, again, is primarily in one of governance at the 8-Star board manager level and providing the technical and commercial support to effectively move the project forward. And that's where our daily engagement and working alongside Glen Farm and providing the expertise in terms of any of those engagement with not only our commercial entities, gas supply, LNG offtake, engineering contracts, that's what we are still providing as part of the project as a minority owner. We are looking at equity investment options for the state of Alaska, and we'll discuss this later. But we're here to make sure that Glen Farm adheres to, again, the contracts that we signed with them, and that they adhere to diligent project development efforts and meet the milestones that were laid out in those agreements. In that, it includes advocating for the terms that we described as the Alaska Advantage Principles.
For the record, Matt Kissinger. This may also shed more light on Representative Josephson's question about what we're getting for the amount that we've already spent on the project. So we've retained 25% of the project, and we're being carried through to FID, meaning that we're not having any of the project us now until with that 25%. So this 25% investment is in 8-Star Alaska LLC, called as the Project Co. Underneath that, you're going to have three subsidiaries, one for the gas treatment plant, one for the pipeline, one for the LNG facility. As we raise funds at FID, at Phase 1 and Phase 2 FIDs for those sub-projects, we'll be letting go of as little amount of equity in those projects as possible from this 8-star Alaska ownership. What we retain in ownership at the 8-star Alaska level in those subsidiaries will flow through to AGDC as the 25% owner, as these sort of developer economics. And this is a very standard way to bring these projects together. Point to Freeport LNG as an example. So in addition to all the tax benefits, which are separate from what Glenfarne would receive, so we have a totally different profile of benefits coming to us in the terms of taxes at upstream development. But we also will be receiving developer economics at 25%. And this is regardless of whether we invest in sub-projects or not. So this is already locked.
Through the chair, Mr. Kissinger, you said we would try to hold on to as much of the 25% as possible. That sounds uncomfortable to me. What would prohibit you, assuming we could post $3 billion for our share in the initial phase, et cetera, what would prohibit you? Why are you under any duress to hold on to the 25%?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think that was maybe a misunderstanding. It's not trying to hold on to the 25%. So right now, 8-Star Alaska owns 100% of those three subsidiaries. As we raise equity in those subsidiaries, of course, we'll have to transfer. As we raise funds for those three subsidiaries, we'll have to transfer equity. So we're not trying to hold on to AGDC's 25%. That's locked in. That's done. What we're trying to do is hold on to 8-Star Alaska's equity in each of the subsidiaries. And that'll just come through the negotiations and the level that we've de-risked the project as we go into FID.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Speaker Edgman?
Maybe I'm getting a little bit impatient. It feels like we've had this presentation before, and if it's different, we had, you know, two times henceforth. I want to hear why there's optimism in this project, where we're at today, why we feel like we get to FID here shortly, why we're going along the stages, all these ABCs of how this project, we've heard all this before, have we not? I mean, this feels to me very repetitive.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, you're absolutely right. We did go through these. These are sort of almost a reminder and I think clarifying that we're still where we are with these. I think the meat of this is going to come through Glenn's presentation a little bit later, and we can accelerate through our slides.
I think that would be a good idea to accelerate.
Yeah, let's move forward.
Thank you. Thank you. Speaker Edgman.
I think that's enough for development.
And I went to the chair, Frank Richards again. Alaska Governance gone through this. It was really just to identify for the public to be able to bring them up to speed in terms of what the goal is that AGDC is working on with Glenfarne to make sure that their project is moving and advancing to the time frames that they delivered to, as well as maintaining the permits and approvals that were granted to them under that transfer responsible. The Alaska Advantage Principles.
Again, that is effective. If you have confidence, Alaska any contracts with the project has to be with and so establishing Alaska presence is important. We're already built up. But the big ones is delivering gas to Alaskans and so that is the objective. It's enshrined in all the future contracts.
Madam Chair, in the interest of time, I can slip past these slides.
I think that would be a good idea.
I think the one that we would like to talk about is again on slide number 11,
okay,
which is about the discussion about equity distribution for the state of Alaska. And we've talked previously about our reservation of up to 25% to those sub-projects and what that would mean in terms of when those investment decisions are going to occur. So for Phase 1 pipeline, early 2026, gas treatment in 27, as well as LNG facility in 2027. You'll hear from Glenfarne again how they're advancing this project. But what we have talked about previously with the community is where does the state of Alaska fit into that equity discussion and whether or not the state of Alaska wants to invest. So I'll ask Matt to describe the preemptive.
So preemptive rights are there are two ways to do this. One is for the state to actively participate in investment alongside, which takes a lot of sophistication. Sitting alongside the clients of the backlog, of investors. The other way is to put back. This is actually quite common for most governments to do. This is in Morocco, where the state has the ability to maintain the expertise and successes. The upstream is sort of all of this. Essentially, people buying the investors. And those investors accept that the state is able into up to 25% on the same terms as the issue. So we get two benefits here. Price discovery for the investors negotiated, but we also get all the other nuanced benefits of traps detail and invested. So what will happen is FID will occur and a 6-month clock will start to get. And during that 6-month clock, we'll need to invest.
We'll need to determine. Sorry, pardon. We'll need to determine as Alaskans whether to invest or not. And this ability for Alaskans to invest, it's for the state to invest. It's for other corporations of the state to invest, but also individual Alaskans. Any questions on how that will work?
Let's see. So, I think that is probably a good idea, unless the committee members think differently. But I want to thank you for your presentation, and I want to thank the prior presentations. But I think this afternoon, Glen Pharma is the highlight of our meeting. So with that said, the committee welcomes Adam Prestige, president of Glen Pharma Alaska LNG. Mr. Prestige was a late addition to the roster, the agenda, and we're so glad that you were able to join us today. And we really look forward to your presentation and following discussion. So please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Chair Gray Jackson, members of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, my name is Adam Prestige, and I'm the president of Glen Pharma Alaska and the co-president of 8-Star Alaska, our joint venture with the state. As a partner to the state of Alaska on this important project, it's a pleasure and a privilege to speak with you today. The Alaska LNG project is one of the most important infrastructure projects in the world. Once completed, it will be a major force in global energy markets, strengthen American energy dominance, and most importantly for our conversation today, deliver reliable, affordable, and scalable energy to Alaskans for decades to come. At Glen Pharma, we have tremendously appreciated the warm welcome that we have received as new participants in the Alaskan community. I'll say it up front, a project like this requires strong partnerships, and our intent is to maintain a powerful, permanent partnership with the state of Alaska as we deliver this project. With that in mind, I'm very happy to address you today. In less than 8 months since Glen Pharma became the lead developer of Alaska LNG, we have taken this project from an ambitious dream to a point of reality and feasibility, and we're driving it further towards commencing construction every day. However, when initially invited to address you recently, we first requested that we postpone this update until January. The reality is that in a period of less than 8 months, we've taken this project and accelerated it at an incredible pace. I can tell you quite honestly that we eat, sleep, and breathe Alaska LNG. That fast-moving pace means that there are many things that are still in progress, and some of our most important project elements are currently under sensitive commercial negotiations. Our initial response and our request to postpone this session for until the near future was partially based on a concern that we wouldn't be able to give a fulsome update because a lot of the most important things that are happening right now are under confidential negotiations with third parties. However, we continue to advance the project, and we have had a number of public positive successes that we are happy to share with you today. With that in mind, I will tell you up front that I may not be able to answer every single question of this committee, especially as it relates to matters that are under confidential negotiations with external parties. However, I will do my best to update on everything that I possibly can on this project. Before I dive exactly into the details of the project and where we're up to, I want to just remind you a little bit about Glenfarne. This is the first time that Glenfarne has had the opportunity to present to the legislature in a joint committee. And so I'd like to take a moment to explain to you why Glenfarne is uniquely qualified to be your partner on this project. We are a U.S.-based, privately owned developer, investor, owner, and operator of energy infrastructure assets. We own over 60 operating power and energy facilities across a global footprint of 8 countries. We employ approximately 900 people across the full range of the industry, from maintenance crews on site to network operating engineers to investment professionals and everything in between. We're employee owned. We're not a hedge fund. We're not a private equity fund. What that means is we don't have defined fund timelines that require us to sell our assets and return and make a return to investors. Quite the opposite. Every project that we've come into, we come into on the expectation that we will own it for the project's lifetime. We're also not a public company, so that means that we don't have to worry about how our quarterly earnings will be interpreted by public markets. Instead, we're able to take a patient, long-term view in everything that we do, and like all of our other investments, we intend to be a part of Alaska LNG for the long haul. Our structure allows us to be hyper-creative, quick-moving, and to deliver on complex challenges. In these complex challenges, we've established a track record of success that sovereign governments rely upon for their most critical energy needs. Our customers include national governments, regional power grids, and local utilities, those for whom failure is not an option. And I'll share with you an important example. In the country of Chile, we operate a network of over 25 grid stability power generation units. They are effectively the nation's backup generator. In early 2025, the entire nation of Chile nearly collapsed into a total energy blackout. Our 25 power plants, which are all controlled at a central network center we designed in Santiago, Chile, immediately came online and helped prevent the country from falling into a long-term blackout. This is the record of performance and reliability at a sovereign scale that we bring to Alaska. Because of our employee ownership, deep finance expertise, and operating track record, we're able to take an aggressive, entrepreneurial approach to advancing this project faster and at a lower cost than traditional large oil and gas companies, while at the same time maintaining a firm commitment to safety standards and operational reliability. Obviously, you want to hear about Alaska LNG and why this project is ready to go forward now after being talked about for many decades. I'll go through some of the fundamentals of ultimately why we came into this project, the fundamentals that we rely on when we are basically pitching this project to investors and customers and stakeholders. And then I'll go further into the details of what we've accomplished over the last 8 months and where we intend to take the project from here. This project is incredibly unique as a major infrastructure project in the sense that it is fully permitted with all of the major permits it needs to go to FID. That is a very privileged position for any project to be in. At the same time, as we heard a little bit from the Gaffney Klein gentleman, there are abundant natural gas reserves on the North Slope. They're a stranded asset with only one way to be brought to market in any scalable way, and that's through this pipeline. This project also enjoys and benefits from very strong political support from Washington, and I respectfully say here at home in Washington, in Alaska. One of the key accomplishments of this project over the last couple of years has been breaking this project down from being a fully integrated mega project into phases that can be accomplished on a more sequential basis, basically de-risking the project one step at a time. Then lastly, the comment that was raised about the tremendous amount of work that has gone into this project in the past by many different parties, the investment that has been made, that has led to a very robust set of engineering and other design information that now puts this project at a very ready state from a technical perspective to being taken into FID. What this means is that we're successfully driving forward on our overall schedule for having the pipeline at completion of construction by the end of 2028 and flowing gas to Alaskans shortly thereafter. That's the most critical milestone, the most meaningful part of our entire timeline. In the very near term, in service of that 2028 completion timeline, we are working and achieving the major milestones necessary to maintain this overall project schedule. To name a few, our engineering firm Worley will conclude the final engineering and final price estimates on the project by the end of the year, which is on schedule with our earliest commitment with them. We'll be selecting contractors, executing contracts, and announcing the consortium of construction firms that will build the pipeline. In the very near term, we'll also be commencing steel production and place purchase orders for hundreds of millions of dollars of steel that will be carried out by domestic and global steel mills and pipe mills and delivered here into Alaska. And then lastly, we will be, not lastly, but here on this list, we will be commencing early civil works to prepare the pipeline route for construction. These actions keep us on track and on schedule for our ultimate timeline of flowing gas to Alaskans. And of course, a lot of discussion around FID. What I will say about FID is that a gas pipeline from the North Slope has been a vision for literal decades. As I've outlined, we're taking concrete, tangible steps to advancing this project to completion in 2028. We've pushed this project further than anyone before, and we aren't slowing down. While a final investment decision is an important term of art in the project finance world, in the project finance process, rest assured that Glenfarne is fully committed to Alaska and to this pipeline and is taking all of the necessary steps on the overall timeline to completing it on time. As I mentioned in my introduction, a project of this magnitude and complexity has many variables, many of which are under confidential negotiations, and those variables impact the FID date. So the reality is that I can't sit here and give you an exact FID date, but I can tell you that we are successfully getting closer and closer. We remain on track, the overall completion timeline. We don't see any major impediments. I see a lot of challenges, but I don't see any total showstoppers. And again, very soon, we will be executing the contracts, financing, and commencing the activities that are necessary to maintain that schedule. In the 8 months of our work on this project, we've done a number of things. We've established a presence here in Alaska, new participants here. We've opened an office. We anticipate growing that office quite quickly. We are growing that office. We're hiring Alaskans and building a platform here in Alaska. We've appointed Worley, one of the largest and most capable engineering firms in the world, to lead the final engineering work on this project. We've launched a very extensive, a very detailed construction contractor selection process. We've gone out to both Alaskan firms and all of the largest pipeline contractors in North America and globally to bid for opportunities to construct this pipeline. We've also signed preliminary LNG agreements with buyers. I've got a slide here. I'll talk about that in much more detail because it's very significant. We've signed strategic partners, and I'll go into more detail, but we've seen some of the most capable, sophisticated companies in the world formally join in the partnership to complete this project. We're deep in engagement with gas suppliers, gas supply from the North Slope, and on a daily basis, we're engaged with our stakeholders in Washington regarding the levels of federal support and interest in this project. Beyond that, we've also initiated design and engineering on the LNG facility in Nikiski, looking at updating the front-end engineering and design and other elements of the marine infrastructure and the storage tanks. And then finally, we have spent a lot of time in facilitating community conversations and ensuring that we, Glenfarne, as a partner to the state and as the lead developer of this project, remain accessible and communicative with the community.
Senator Diesel.
Could I ask a question at this point?
Please.
So I'm looking at these last two slides, 3 and 4. This list of accomplishments have been achieved with our current tax structure. No changes to it. No guarantee of fiscal stability. How critical are those elements?
It's a great question, through the chair, Senator Diesel. They're important. And there's a couple of things that I will say about that. First, our priority has been to update the cost of the project. And as I mentioned, Worley is concluding that by the end of the year. It would be difficult for us to have a fulsome, comprehensive conversation with you about the project costs and about the need for any kind of property tax adjustment without being able to have a thoughtful, a complete picture of what the project costs are. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion today about fiscal stability, and that is a very important concept. What I will say about fiscal stability is obviously the opposite of that is fiscal instability, or at least uncertainty. And I can tell you that those who build these projects and pay for them hate uncertainty more than anything. And so when it comes to any kind of fiscal uncertainty, that risk needs to be taken on by someone in the chain. And so that might be, it depends. There's a lot of commercial counterparties. There's a lot of places for that risk to reside. The ultimate result is that it results in a cost increase for the infrastructure. At the same time, when it comes to property tax, that's an important discussion. There are a lot of things happening very quickly on this project, and the need to address that is part of the reason why we ultimately agreed to come here and have this session with you today. Again, it requires a bit more work on the ultimate project cost, but it is an important part of the conversation.
Need to follow up, sir?
No, I don't think so.
You're welcome. Certainly.
So, FID is a term of art, because that's exactly what I was thinking in the conversation today. But FID, for all intents and purposes, what you're presenting to us, doesn't mean FID. It doesn't. Because you can't put a cost curve, revenue curve, without all these other factors. And early engineering, my standpoint as a layperson, might be able to put the cost together for the steel and things like that. You know, elements that are quantifiable. But if you don't have the full picture in terms of your revenue stream throughout the life cycle of this project, can't get to FID. I don't think, but I'm asking you to refute that. And also, if you could put in the context of phase one, is that a separate FID?
Sure.
Phase two, is that separate to that? And it feels like FID is not just a term of art, but it's just a term.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, what is important to us, and again, why I started this conversation with a focus on the long-term vision, completing the project by the end of 2028. In order to serve that, we intend to make significant expenditures of capital to cure the pipeline, to have the pipeline delivered here, to have real machinery up and down the pipeline route, preparing the route for greater construction. That's gravel, it's pads, it's a tremendous amount of civil work. And then a number of other activities to prepare for the full construction period of time. Where the event of FID occurs within those early works, I think that is something that will be determined as we resolve a lot of these confidential negotiation processes.
So I think you said a moment ago, too, that FID is related to a term of art related to project financing. How can you get long-term investors if you don't know where we're at in terms of tax regime, stability, things like that?
So one of the things, obviously, if you're making an investment, as we are, earlier in a project than later when all of those things have been fully settled, there is a greater risk to those early to that earlier investment, and that is part of the investment decision that's made at that time for that type of work.
The chair, I'm not quite sure what you're saying. I fully understand that you have your, you know, maybe not one hand, both hands tied, and you have sensitive agreements in place and discussions that are beyond the scope certain public forum. I'm just trying to get a sense of some basics here. But, in line with the earlier presentation that we had, you know, given that you know, you're talking to a committee that may be instrumental in the work that be done next session if this thing is on accelerated timeline to getting a you know, pipeline in place by 2028, which, by the way, would be obviously, we've heard transformational for times today. It truly would be.
Yep.
So I'm not trying to throw cold water. I'm just trying to get a sense or the discussion from the public to understand things. But it would be helpful.
Sure.
You know, I want to hear why you're so optimistic.
Sure. And apologies for being unclear through the chair, Representative Edgman. To clarify, and I think to answer what you're asking, by the time you get to the point of putting together the full financing of every single dollar and cent needed to take this project to complete the completion of construction, all of these risks, all of these questions, everything that we're talking about today needs to be resolved. However, for some of these early works, for the you know preliminary things that need to occur in occur in the project in order to maintain that to that completion timeline, those expenditures, those investments can be made even while some of the other elements of the project are pending resolution. They are frankly more risky because there are assumptions that are being made and parts of the ultimate project package that need to be finalized. But you know, I think our level of optimism in the project will justify making those expenditures.
Yeah. Certainly.
So is this a three-phase project or a two-phase project, as you know it to be today?
In terms of looking at kind of FID events, I look at it as a two-phase project. There are three sub-projects. There's the pipeline, there's the LNG export facility, there's the gas treatment facility on the North Slope. And to keep things as simple as I can, essentially, we will FID and commence construction on the pipeline at one event, and a separate event, FID the export facility probably a year or so after the pipeline commences full construction.
Would you like to follow up?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, again, as you know it today, Glenn Farne is making progress in a way that you certainly can't talk about fully in front of a legislative committee, but you're making progress on phase one in a way that leads you to be optimistic about your earlier statement of actually getting you know, gas in motion in 2028, which is what, 2 years basically?
End of 2020.
End of 2028. So is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. And part of our optimism does come from the parallel progress that we're making on phase two, the LNG export facility. So even though the sequence is first FIDing and starting construction on the pipeline, there is tremendous work going on at the same time on advancing the LNG export facility. A lot of that is driven by customer interest. Quite frankly, we are seeing that our negotiations for LNG sales to global customers has been accelerated by global market interest in this project. And what you see is that even though the pipeline is essentially going first, the LNG export facility is ultimately the long-term anchor of this project. And so progress on the LNG export facility drives the pipeline and vice versa.
I guess my last question, if I might, appreciate the indulgence here. I appreciate your responses. Will there be work to sort of follow Senator Giesel's line of questioning? Will there be work with the legislature on anything that you've heard today?
Yes, Senator, excuse me, Representative Edgman through the chair. I believe that there will be. and that is upcoming. And again, today represents our first meeting with the legislature, but that's going to be an important part of the work. I know that AGDC is working with the governor on a task force with various borough mayors to address property tax solutions that may be needed here on this project. And so I do anticipate that on property tax in particular, there will be further engagement with the legislature.
So I guess if I one last time.
You certainly.
My concluding takeaway then from this meeting today is that the 2026 legislative session could be dominated by policy measures to advancing the Alaska gas line. Am I mischaracterizing that, or perhaps overstating it?
Representative Edgman, excuse me, and through the chair, I think it will be a very important part of the legislative agenda.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Diesel. Thank you, Madam Chair. You talked about phase one being the pipeline. I assume that includes the gas treatment facility.
Senator Giesel, through the chair, as a technical matter, it does not. The specifications necessary for gas that is exported as LNG is a higher standard of gas purity than is necessary for utility-grade consumption for domestic users. And at that very high volume, we need a very large gas treatment facility to bring the North Slope gas down to LNG spec, but the specifications that are satisfactory for domestic consumption here in Alaska are not at the same level, and so we don't need a very large gas treatment facility on the North Slope. We do need a very significantly smaller kind of preliminary treatment set for the domestic demand. The scale of that is equivalent to the scale of what's being transported in Phase 1, which is less than 10% of the total volume.
Thank you. I assume that's a CO2.
Yes, partly.
Thank you. So, you know what we sitting here at this table do for a living, so to speak, is we represent Alaskans. And their interest is the cost of this gas. And so as Alaskans are hearing that this pipeline will be available in 2 years, they're asking the question of, is it affordable to us? So that is a key question that we're going to keep pushing you.
Absolutely.
On. What's the cost to Alaskans to buy our own gas? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson and then Representative
Bob. It sounded like Mr. Steech wanted to respond, or are we ready for my question?
Representative Josephson, happy to address your question.
Through the chair, who's paying for it? About a third of the way through this presentation, you were speaking about pipe being rolled and the purchase of pipe. I couldn't tell in the sequence whether that was before FID. Who's paying for that pipe?
Those Representative Justice have sent through the chair. The initial early works, including the pipe purchases, will be funded by Glenn Farn.
Follow. Is that above and beyond the $150 million commitment?
Yes, it is.
Okay. It's my understanding, and I have folks I can ask who know the answer for sure. You talked about negotiating with local governments for some reduction of the property and equipment tax, but the state has to be a party to those negotiations at some point. Is that right?
Representative Justin, through the chair, I believe that's correct. And I can tell you that, again, that is our commitment. When I look at this project, I think one of the key features here is that this is a joint venture between Glenfarne and the state of Alaska. We know that we can't do this in a vacuum, and we need cooperation and communication and participation with the state to take this project
forward. And if I could, I meant to ask this earlier, but when we reached that point, which is would come soon, according to one slide, where we would either invest or not invest in the equity share, and that's a whole 6 months is nothing when I look at that difficult question. I'm curious, if we decline to do it, would we be selling away our rights, or would we be giving those rights to the project?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, when that right is essentially put on the table for the state of Alaska, there will be multiple options to participate. That right exists at each FID of each of the different sub-projects, and so the state will have the opportunity to evaluate each of the sub-projects and where and when the state desires to participate. That will be ultimately both a political decision and a financial decision, where the state will have the picture of the costs, the expected returns, and will be able to make a decision whether or not it wants to participate in the equity project.
Just that. Well, I appreciate that we would get the opportunity at each important benchmark. The first one is, you know, I'm thinking about baseball. The first out is the most important. The first one could be the most important. Is that possible? I mean, we don't want to miss the dance. If we're in, we got to get in, and that would start in the first instance, wouldn't it,
Senator Representative Josephson, through the chair? I, as a person, generally agree with you. I think that goes to a little bit of the interest of the state and how and when the state wants to invest. It's just as an individual, it seems to me that being a participant in a pipeline project that delivers gas to Alaskans as the first phase would have a priority.
Thank you.
You're
welcome. Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Prestige, would you say that it is good for the public to recognize that while you are certainly under NDAs going through negotiations, to look at what you have done, commitments that you have made in hundreds of millions of dollars, even without tax questions resolved, even with letting out contracts to open up the right-of-ways, to making sure that this project is moved, that's an indication, as Mr. Representative Benjamin was saying, of your level of confidence in the project. From a layperson's perspective, it doesn't seem like you would be doing this with these open questions. That's also, in my view, an indication to us, without being able to lay out all your cards, that you also need a willing partner at this dance, but that you're willing to take the lead and a very significant risk. Am I saying what you're not saying?
Representative Kopp, I through the chair, I agree with you. And what I will say is that you can sit here and listen to me talk about my passion for the project or Glenn Farn's commitment to the project. But more importantly, I want to take you back to some of the conversations that myself and our CEO had with many of you very, very early in our participation here in Alaska, where we promised that we would come in and we would quarterback a consortium of very capable partners who would deliver this project. And as enthusiastic and optimistic as I am about this project, what I would ask instead is that you look to the partners who are joining into the commitment to execute this project. In not only have we hired and have the full strength of Worley, one of the largest engineering firms in the world, working on this project, we also signed a preliminary agreement with POSCO, the largest manufacturer of steel out of Korea, who have committed to provide a significant amount of the steel for this project and also buy LNG from the export facility. And then last week in Washington, D.C., we announced the execution of definitive agreements for Baker Hughes to be a partner in this project with us as well. Baker Hughes is the global leader in energy technology. They have invested in a number of different LNG projects. They pride themselves on only investing in the projects that they truly believe are going to go forward. And they have made a strong commitment to this project. And so I would say yes, as enthusiastic as I am, I'd say look to the partners and customers who are coming to this project because they believe in it as well.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. As I mentioned, when it comes to the market interest, not only have we had strategic partners like POSCO, Worley, and Baker Hughes come into the project, but we've also benefited from accelerated success in marketing LNG. The LNG export facility is 20 million tons of export capacity. In order to achieve project financing, we would want to have, or we, our target is to have 80% of the export capacity under long-term third-party contracts. So that's 16 million tons. So here we are with 11 million tons of customer commitments. We are more than halfway to getting to that $16 million ton number. What I will say to that, of course, is that those volumes are largely committed under letters of intent, which we know are legally non-binding. However, I can tell you that LNG purchase commitments are a long process, and they start with these initial indications of interest. The group that we have had sign LOIs with this project include a diverse panel of the most sophisticated buyers of LNG in the world. You have CPC, the National Oil and Gas Company of Taiwan. You have PTT, the National Oil and Gas Company of Thailand. JERA in Japan is the largest buyer of LNG in the world, and they're as sophisticated and conservative as can possibly be in the market. I've talked about POSCO out of Korea, and then following JERA's commitment, Tokyo Gas also stepped up and publicly announced their desire to buy 1 million tons from the project. With these letters of intent, not only are they signed and announced, but in each case they're endorsed by either the heads of government or the energy ministers of these countries and of our country. And so for a long-term LNG sales partnership, you couldn't ask for a better foundation for these relationships. They're not just the result of excitement or good PR or good marketing. They're the result of a careful, methodical process of educating our customers on the advantages of this project. And they have deployed teams of technicians and engineers and financial analysts to get to this point. I can tell you that numerous trips to Japan, sitting with not only our customers, but with energy think tanks, with energy ministers and different parts of the Japanese government, to help them understand the advantages of this project and why it's going forward. So again, take my word, if you will, but also look to some of the commitments from some of the most conservative and sophisticated buyers of LNG in the world who do believe that this project is going forward. If I may, I'm going to shift the attention to our commitment to Alaska and what we've done for engaging with Alaskan contractors and Alaskan labor. You've heard us talk about our commitment to being a partner with Alaska, and that's not just talk. That's one of our most important tenets of this project, and we're backing that up. Engagement and opportunity for Alaskan firms and Alaskan workers to participate in this project are a huge priority for us, and our team dedicates a significant amount of time, cost, and effort into making this possible. One recent example of that is a contractor summit that we held in Anchorage about 6 weeks ago, where we invited over 100 different Alaskan firms, including Alaska Native Corporation groups, village and tribal corporations, and other service provider firms. And we had over 200 participants come to that and hear about the project, about the progress, and about the opportunities to participate in that. But it wasn't just a one-off morning project update. I can tell you that coming out of that, we've had over 50 private meetings with those partners, with those contractors that came and participated, and we've taken the time to do one-on-one meetings and explain the opportunity in detail for any of those that have asked. Our goal and our commitment is to be, as I said, accessible and communicative. In addition to that, we've held other open houses. I mentioned we opened an Anchorage office, and we continue to make sure that our engagement and our adherence to the Alaska Advantage principles is a central part of how we operate in the state. We've also been very engaged in developing the collaboration necessary for the workforce to execute this project. And so our engagement on that is with contractors, with unions, State Department of Labor, with the University of Alaska, and with local training centers to make sure that the workforce, that all of these participants come together to make sure that the workforce is available to complete this project, and that it emphasizes Alaska hiring We've got a picture here. We recently did a town hall in Nikiski to give an update on the project. It had been some number of years since they had a proper update. Robust interest, a lot of questions, and we spent the evening there just fielding questions from anyone and everyone in the community that wanted to get an update on the project. In terms of, I gave an overview, kind of a highlight of our contractor selection process, but that bullet point that I gave early doesn't fully capture the intensity of work that we've put in on this project. We have gone out to global market participants and put out a very, very detailed RFP for steel production, and we've had bidders from all around the world for the steel, for line pipe. Ultimately, the steel is produced in a steel mill. It's then the steel slab is then shipped to a pipe mill that rolls the steel into actual pipe. So we have many bids that we're evaluating for pipe mills. We have a number of bids that we have received and we're evaluating for contractors who will actually build the project. And again, that goes to a lot of the risk elements that we talked about that are currently subject to careful negotiations. Man camps that need to be installed on the pipeline route, that's something that needs to be procured and manufactured ahead of time. So we've conducted an RFP and received bids for that, for gravel, for logistics, for fuel, for valves, all of these things, many dozens of bids for these different parts of the project that we're now evaluating. You see here a list of a rough estimate of the different job opportunities that will be, the different roles that will be needed to complete the pipeline construction. It's a significant amount. Again, we're doing what we can to prioritize Alaska Hiring and communicate that with not just prioritize Alaska Hiring, but make sure that communities aren't surprised and blindsided by the need and the influx of labor to work on this project. In conclusion, I want to be clear that this large, historic, and complex project is anything but easy. I think that's very clear. As optimistic as we are, there are some questions that I can't answer today. There will be new challenges that will arise that we will have to address, but I can give you Glenfarne's commitment that our unique skill set and our commitment to this project are suited for addressing those challenges. We're fully committed to driving this project forward to completion, and we look forward to continued dialogue with the legislature and engagement, cooperation, and we appreciate your support.
Thank you. Are there any other questions, Senator Diesel?
Well, perhaps more of a comment, Madam Chair. I appreciate Glenn Tarn's enthusiasm. Your enthusiasm is obvious. We've had a lot of development in our state, starting with the Russians, who were very enthusiastic about our fish and furs, going on to miners who came for our gold. Then we had oil companies, and now we have gas, right? So we've been here before. You have enumerated the workforce that you're looking for. That's great. I was here when TAPS was built. I know the out-of-state workforce that will be required here. Right now, 24% of our working people in Alaska do not live here. During TAPS, we had an income tax. Today, we do not. I have to take all of this into account as I think about this project and representing the best interests of my state and the people that live here. So, thank you for this presentation. I appreciate it. I think it's the most clear, beneficial presentation I've heard so far on this project. So thank you for being here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Please. Senator Giesel, thank you for those comments. What I will respond to that is, yes, we're absolutely enthusiastic. I want to be clear, though, that enthusiasm is underpinned by our expertise in developing and financing these projects. We've built and financed and operated 60 assets across the Americas. We're building and developing LNG projects on the U.S. Gulf Coast, and we're very close to FIDing another project. And so that enthusiasm comes from our core belief in the commercial and finance and technical elements of this project being in place. On the latter element, I can tell you that we greatly appreciate an understanding and a perspective, like you share about being part of here during TAPS, of the impact of workforce development here in the state, and that dialogue and understanding those perspectives from you is very important to us so that we can shape how we take this project.
Thank you. I just want to give Senator Willikowski an opportunity if you have any questions, and if I don't hear you, that means you don't have a question. But Senator Willikowski? Okay. And we also have three legislators in the audience, and I just want to give you an opportunity. If you have a question, please be brief. I'm giving you an opportunity. Not being committee members, I'm giving you an opportunity to ask a question. Okay, Representative Mears.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm looking a little bit more short-term and wondering if you had anything to share on LNG import, the status of that project and timeline.
Through the Chair, Representative Mears, thanks for bringing that up. I mentioned earlier that part of our work over the last 8 months has been reviewing and conducting the engineering on the marine terminal and the LNG storage tank on the site of the Alaska LNG facility. That does go into the potential for LNG imports. We continue to push forward on the optionality and the capability of LNG exports as a part of the overall Alaska LNG project. We view that as a potential short-term solution to any energy shortage and also essentially a long-term backup option for energy security if ever needed in the future.
Is there a timeline?
The timeline on that project is a complicated question because the timeline is not dissimilar to the overall timeline of the pipeline. Which has completion of the import terminal around the end of 2020.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome. Any other comments from the committee members before we adjourn? Okay, I just want to let you know, well, thank you for your presentation and everyone here who presented today. We really appreciate it. But I just want to let the committee know that we're tentatively planning on holding another LBNA meeting in January, first week of the session, so that you know ahead of time. And with nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 4:16 p.m.